Okay, good evening, everyone. Something that I learned very early in my policing career is to expect the unexpected, that you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, and sometimes there's no winning. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to get into a peeing match with someone. I think I can say peeing on the show. And, of course, we all know what went on in Cambridge. The Cambridge police officer, the Harvard professor, the president of the United States. I bet you when that sergeant went to work, he didn't think that this would go on. I thought I'd bring on Clint Van Zandt. You know, Clint is a retired FBI agent, a author, a media analyst, someone who is familiar with policing for sure, to talk about this. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dana. Good evening.
I'll bet you that Sergeant Crowley, when he strapped on his Sam Brown that morning and went out and was handling his calls, never thought that he'd get involved in something like this. Your thoughts on the Crowley? Can we call it Crowley Gate?
Yeah, well, you know, I think number one, the Sergeant Crowley, Jim Crowley, had no idea the firestorm he was going to step into.
Yeah,
I think, you know, when you take a look at the situation, you see the good Professor Gates, I think, did racial baiting. I think he worked his hardest to try to bait that police sergeant into some type of incident. I think the sergeant, unfortunately, took the bait.
Yep.
And so if the professor started the fire, I think the sergeant, unfortunately, threw a couple of logs on it, and then the president of the United States came along and poured gasoline on it. So, you know, the situation just got out of hand very quickly, all sides.
You know, when you, you look at police work, you know police work, I know it, but most of my audience don't understand that when you walk into a situation like this, and you use the term baiting, which is a good term, as a sergeant, supervisor, whatever you want to say, there's other officers on the scene, someone is using that the racial aspect of it, and all of a sudden, you know, your emotions get the best of you, because even as an officer, you're human. But you can't let that take the best of you, because all of a sudden now there's big problems. Obama's trying to settle it with a beer at the White House, but it's started too many fires, I'm afraid to say.
You know, you think of this scenario. You've got a citizen who lives in the neighborhood, calls and reports that there is a black man breaking into a residence. Police put the call out, break it in progress. In the meantime, they run the computer on the address, and they find out that there had been a burglary in the house the week previous.
Yep.
So the first responding officer gets to the scene, Sergeant Crowley. He talks to the reporting witness, this female. She said, the guy's in the house already. Crowley, the sergeant, goes up, looks through the glass door. He sees an African-American. He says to the guy inside the house, you know, what are you doing in here? And come out here. I want to talk to you. The first thing out of Professor Gates' mouth is, oh, you're doing this because I'm a black man in America. Well, let's see. You had a witness say an African-American broke into a house. You know the house has been burglarized the previous week. And you go up to the front door, and you see an African-American inside the house. You know, somebody said, I saw a 3 foot, 2 inch, what's the politically correct term for midget? I saw a 3 foot, 2 inch midget go into that front door. And you went in, you go up to the front door as a police officer, and you see somebody a little over 3 foot, and you say, excuse me, will you come out here and talk? I want to talk to you. And that person says, oh, you're picking on me because I'm a midget. No, I'm picking on you because you match the description that the witness gave me, and I want to find out who you are. And when Crowley says, you know, the professor then says something about, I live here, the police officer says, can you show me some ID? So the professor immediately turns around, walks away from the officer, somewhere into the bowels of the house, allegedly going for his college ID. Now, Dana, as a police officer, you don't know what you have.
Yeah.
You don't know if you got a burglar. You don't know, because the report was two burglars. You don't know who's got a gun. And now this guy turns his back and moves away from you, and you're the only officer, you're the first officer on the scene. I tell you what, to me, that would scare me, and it would worry me professionally about what was going to happen next. I mean, I arrested, you know, my first year as an FBI agent, I arrested 100 guys. And over the years, like you, I arrested a lot of people. Well, one thing I learned very quickly, until I knew who a suspect was, he wasn't getting up, walking around a room, going to another room, putting his hands in his pocket. I want to see your hands, and I don't want you moving until I know who you are. And for that man, for Professor Gates, to take offense and to suggest that that was racial profiling, to me, you can't say it's anything but he was trying to bait that officer into a situation.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here, and we're talking about the Gates-Crowley incident in Cambridge. When you look at a situation like this, and it's come out now that the officer Crowley actually instructs racial profiling at the police academy, I think one of the most disappointing things to me was when the president even started talking about racial profiling police. And of course, we can't deny that it's not, you know, we can, if we say that it hasn't gone on, we'd sound silly. But all of a sudden, without knowing the facts, the president, who admits that he didn't know the facts, starts to get on a soapbox. And how disgusting was that?
Well, people throwing this term profiling, oh, you profile, you racially profile. No, the witness said it was one or two African-Americans who just broke into that house, and the first officer on the scene sees an African-American standing inside of the front door that's been broken open. That's not profiling. That's acting on the information that you're giving as the first responding investigator. And people throw that profiling around like it's a state trooper somewhere between Florida and Maine seeing a African-American man driving a new Mercedes-Benz, so he pulls him over and searches the whole car and says, I know you got drugs in here because there's no way that an African-American can drive a car like that. Yeah. That's racial profiling,
yeah.
And that cop ought to get fired for doing something like that. But for what Officer Crowley did was doing his job. Now, let me take that a step further. After the baiting took place, after the professor did everything he could, you know, making reference to the police officer's mother, demanding, calling the police and saying that there's a racist cop at his front door. And, of course, he would later refer to this officer as a rogue cop. What basis does he do that? But all of that said and done, he produces a college ID. Well, of course, that doesn't give his home address. And realize, he doesn't own that house he's in. He's renting it. So when he produces the college ID, Crowley still doesn't know what he's dealing with, but he calls for the college police to come over, verify who this guy is. Well, somewhere along the line, he comes up with a Massachusetts license. It's okay. I understand who you are. The witness is outside. And then as the officer goes outside, Gates follows him. He's yelling at him. He's saying, you don't know who you're messing with. You haven't seen the end of this. That's where I think the police officer made a mistake, Dana.
Yeah.
That's where, and I've had it happen to me. I've had people say, you pig, you, I'm going to get you. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, until they put their hand on you, there's a lot of discretion. And even then, there's discretion that a police officer has. I think once that Sergeant Crowley determined that the guy did live there, was in his house, that he was going to be belligerent no matter what, I think that's the time I would have at least tried, Dana. I would have tried to say, you know what, my name's Sergeant Jim Crowley. I'm with the local police department. Here's my card with my number on it. Sir, if you have a complaint, call the police department and let them know. If you want me to check your house and make sure it's safe, I'll be glad to do it. But otherwise, I'm out of here. And I would have turned and walked away.
Yeah.
And I think what Crowley did was because there was a lot of cops outside, there was a lot of citizens outside, and because the professor was shooting off his mouth still, I think Crowley responded to that, where I think in hindsight, had he simply said, here's my card, call the police department if you have a complaint, and walk down the steps, this thing would have gotten defused. But again, what poured the fuel on it was the President of the United States knowing nothing about the situation whatsoever, but saying, we know how police officers discriminate against African Americans, and this guy is my buddy, so the cops must have been stupid or acted stupidly.
Yeah.
I think for the President, you know, in the United States, in Canada, anywhere else, the head of government, let's take Barack Obama. You're not just Barack Obama.
Yep.
You're not just an African-American. You don't speak as Barack Obama. You don't speak as an African-American. You speak as the president of 310 million people. And when you do that, you have to take a step back and say, if I say something, number one, I say it with authority, and number two, I say it with information. The president is a rookie president. He made a rookie mistake, and hopefully not only he, but Professor Gates and probably Sergeant Crowley learned a lesson from this one.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here, and Clint has an article about the situation at newsvine.com. You'll see a link to it on our show notes. You know, Clint, when you see this and you see these types of cases, and Bill Cosby has actually probably made the most sense out of anyone, and I don't know how he got into this, but he started talking about this. Well, how do we fix it? There's been a lot of damage done.
Yeah, there really has. You know, part of it is just understanding the situation. I saw an interview tonight from a 21-year police officer veteran from that same police department who was at the scene at the time and witnessed everything that went on. He said there was no racial profiling. He said there was the only racism that came up was the comments made by the professor. So the challenge now is that the United States so often were a black and white country, and I tell you what, there are so many people ready to draw that line, and there are so many people ready to say, I'll believe a black no matter what he says, or I'll believe a white no matter what he says, and we line up on those again, and people immediately line up on those racial lines saying, I know what happened 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, so this must be more of the same. Well, as long as people keep thinking like that, as long as they think along racial lines instead of along intelligent lines, instead of thinking what the facts are, and you know, I've heard commenters say the last couple of days, you know, when you stop by a police officer or challenge, the last thing you want to do is be belligerent. And you know, to me, whether the officer is right, wrong, it doesn't make any difference. Right then, it's not who he is by name, it's what he represents. And what he represents is authority over me. Now, if he abuses that authority, sue him, go to his department, do whatever you have to do. But if you want to stand there toe-to-toe and be belligerent and yell, or God forbid, put your hands on a police officer, you know, you're going to go to jail, and you have to understand that. That's just the way the system works. And I would hate for this country to get to the point where you say, wait a minute, there's a potential African-American burglary suspect inside of a house. We have to wait until we get an African-American police officer on scene to make that initial confrontation so that the suspect, who may or may not be ready to shoot the officer, won't claim that there was racial profiling done when he's confronted by the first responding officer. That's the terrible limit that something like this can get to.
Absolutely. It's well said. Clint Van Zandt is here. Just before we finish up, Clint, when you look at this, and we've talked about, and I agree with you somewhat on the mistake that the sergeant made at the end, like when you get into a pissing match with someone. I've done it myself. I can remember very clearly my partner being berated by someone, being called an idiot over and over and over again. And finally, I turn around, I was sitting in front of the patrol car, and I look back at this guy, and I said, you know, there's only one idiot in this car. And I said, it's not my partner, and it's not me. It's the guy sitting in the back seat. And I said, you can go to court and tell the judge I said that, too. Well, guess what? He went to court and he told the judge I said that. And I looked over at the judge, and the judge is looking at me, and he's just shaking his head. But, you know, it's that image of policing, Clint. When you see the most recently, I think there was a trooper somewhere who pulled over an ambulance, and next thing you know, there's a webcam going, and the guy's choking out the ambulance driver.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's garbage. That's absolute garbage. But there are a lot of good cops out there, and I think Crowley is a good cop. He just got caught up in the moment in the situation. He did his job. How do we, as police officers, respond to a situation like this? I know his union has come forward now and condemned the president, but it's a bigger thing than just condemning the president, though.
You know, in the 1950s, there was a very wise man. He was chief of police of the Los Angeles Police Department. And he made a statement that, you know, I thought for police officers, FBI agents, did make any difference. He said, you know, the only problem with choosing police officers is that we have to take them from the human race. And I guess that stuck with me over the years, that short of the badge and the gun, this was a guy You know, he's got a wife. This is a woman who's got a husband. They've got children. They've got parents, grandparents, other issues. And if we go back to the golden rule, you know, do unto others. I tell you what, when you've got a police officer trying to do his job, and, I mean, if you can imagine Clint Van Zandt, white American, being confronted by an African-American police officer and saying, the only reason you pulled me over is because I'm white. Well, that would fall on deaf ears very quickly.
Right.
And yet, you know, he pulled me over because I was doing 90 miles an hour in a 55-mile-an-hour zone. But unfortunately, in this country, there are people who look to play that race card very quickly, and that turns into the Trump card. That when that race card is played, the facts are swept off the table. And the only thing that's left on that table is the race card. Right now, it looks like the professor played that race card very quickly for his own reasons, whether he had some issues going on, whether because he runs the African-American Studies program, he wanted to use himself as a victim. I'm sure he's going to do a movie or a book or something else about this heart-rendering experience he was involved in. Whatever his reason, what he did and what the President of the United States did was not set an example for men and women in this country, number one, to deal with law enforcement, and number two, to deal with racial issues. Because the more and more you water down racism, the harder it is to tell what really is a racist incident and what isn't. We have to be clear of what racism is. What took place in Cambridge was not, and I think to call it that is an attempt to whitewash the facts and sweep them under the table.
Well said. Clint, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Dana.
Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That's Clint Van Zandt. He's a retired FBI agent, hostage negotiator, author, you name it, and a guy that makes a lot of sense. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back with author Fred Rosen talking about his new book, Deadly Angel. And there's a kind of a wild political aspect to this book that involves none other than Sarah Palin. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. There's a new book out called Deadly Angel, the bizarre true story of Alaska's killer stripper. And, of course, you know the author as a semi-regular guest on the program, Fred Rosen. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Dana. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thank you.
We have touched on it, I guess, last time you were here, about this story, about the Alaska's killer stripper. And, in fact, there's even a political side to it that most people will sit back and shake their heads about. But tell us about the book, and then we'll get into the political angle of it, which
sure.
I think is fascinating.
Yeah, well, it really started out as a cold case. In 1996, a man named Kent Lepink, who was a fisherman originally from Michigan, he'd gone to Alaska, and like a lot of individuals who go to Alaska, he'd sort of reinvented himself. And one day, he walked into a strip club called the Great Alaskan Bush.
And I'm sorry. I love the name.
You know what? There were two jokes. First, there was the Great Alaskan Bush, right? And then, of course, there's the Alaska Cold Case Squad, and I didn't make one joke about either.
Okay.
I kept saying to my editor, I said, you know, we got to make a joke. We got to make a joke. He says, I don't have any. I don't have any, you know. But anyway, what happens is he walks into the club, and he sees this gorgeous girl coming down the stairs and falls instantly in love with her, and her name is Michelle Hughes, and she is a stripper who makes thousands of dollars a night.
Right.
And he falls for her. And unbeknownst to him and to other individuals, she winds up getting all three guys as fiancés. So she has fiancé number one, fiancé number two, and fiancé number three.
Oh, God.
And then she happens to see a movie called The Last Seduction in 95, which was a ripoff of Double Indemnity.
Right.
And Double Indemnity, of course, is Billy Wilder's classic film about an insurance salesman who conspires with a woman to kill her husband for the insurance money. And that's what happens here. Michelle Hughes gets fiancé number one, who's John Carlin III, to help her kill fiancé number two, Kent Lepping, the fisherman, for the insurance money.
Mm-hmm.
However, what she doesn't know is that. Oh, I forgot the other part is, like, while this is going to happen, she's going to be in a bubble bath with fiancé number three.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So, but what she doesn't know is that Kent has an idea about what's going to happen. And he writes a letter to his parents. This is in the book, and this is the first part of the book, where he says, in the case of my death, open this letter, et cetera, et cetera. These are the people who killed me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a story about a man who literally loves a woman to death. And at the same time, what occurs is that purely by historical coincidence, shortly after he is killed and the police begin to investigate, Sarah Palin becomes the mayor of the town that he was living in, which is Wasilla, Alaska.
Wow.
And that's the point where Palin gets involved in the case.
Yeah, later on, Fred Rosen's here. We're talking about his new book, Deadly Angel. Later on, she fires the police chief. What's up with that?
Well, what happens is, the Lead Pink murder investigation, the venue for it is the state police. Alaska, in Alaska, except for Anchorage or Juneau, the state police have venue in all major crimes.
Right.
So one would expect that when the state police come in and investigate in a local town, especially Wasilla, which is over 4,000 people, you're going to get some cooperation from the locals.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what happens. What's up is this. Palin gets elected. And this stuff came out during the election, and she immediately asks for the resignations of all of the people who hold office in the town government as a show of loyalty. And Earl Stambaugh is the chief of police. He resigns, just like everybody else, expecting to get rehired, but that doesn't happen. She decides to fire him. And suddenly, the Wasilla Police Department is rudderless during this major murder investigation where the state police needed all the help they could get in order to track that, in order to prove that Michelle Hughes and John Carlin murdered Kent Lepink. And basically what occurs is that the case goes into a black hole and does not get solved until the millennium.
Now, Michelle herself starts a new life, I guess one could say.
Yes, very similar to Sarah Jane Moore, former member of the SLA.
Right.
Yes, what she does is she goes back to New Orleans, where she's originally from. And she winds up meeting a man there who is a doctor. And his name is Colin Linehan. And she winds up marrying him and moving to Washington State and starts a whole new life as June Cleaver. I don't know how many people remember June Cleaver.
I do.
That's from Leave It to Beaver, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
But she winds up going there, and she starts a new life, and she gets a master's degree, she bakes cookies, she goes next door and has play dates, she has a child. And then one day, around 2006, the Alaska State Police come calling. And they say, we have a warrant for your arrest for murder. And what the book does is show how they investigate it and how they put it together. And which, of course, takes quite some time. And at the same time, what Mayor Palin's involvement or lack thereof is in the case.
The book is Deadly Angel, and there's a link on the show notes about how you can purchase it.
Right. It's a book by HarperCollins, the publisher. You can go to Barnes & Noble.
Yep.
.com or Amazon.com or go to your local bookstore.
Now, Wasilla, Alaska, population 4,200. You got a feel for the police chief, fired, resigned, whatever. They don't have many murders like this in Alaska. How big of a case was this up there?
Well, that's an excellent point, Dana, excellent point. And the answer is, at first, it wasn't a big case because the body was dumped 80 miles away, which in Alaska is really not much, But Kent was shot three times, including once in the face, which to me showed there was something personal about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the state police began investigating, and immediately they tabbed the John Carlin and Michelle Hughes as the suspects. But at the and again, it is an unusual situation, very unusual, which is why I wondered why it was in a town of 4,000 that Mayor Palin wasn't more involved, and I get into that in the book. And the hard part about it as a writer and a reporter was that this happened purely by coincidence. Mm-hmm. You know, one day I was sitting there writing the book. Next thing you know, I look up at the screen and John McCain is nominating her as vice president. And I went, oh my God, I've got to investigate a vice presidential candidate during an election. And I went, oh, I don't want to do this. But of course I did. I investigated her as far as her tenure as mayor was concerned and how she was involved with this particular case. And it was quite interesting because you do see certain patterns. Like, for instance, when she fires the police chief, I mean, when you look into that, and I get into that again in the book, it then becomes no surprise that she has problems with the state police later on vis-a-vis her brother-in-law, who was a state policeman, and allegedly she got him fired because he had divorced her sister. And that was stuff that came out during the election. The last thing I expected was that she would still be in the news when the book came out in the summer of 2009, but here she is.
Yeah, alive and well. And the small-town politics with a mayor with a, if you want to call it an agenda, that turns out to be a vendetta, if you want to look at it that way, certainly has come back to open up a lot of eyes. Now, we don't want to give away the whole book. Again, the book is Deadly Angel. You can get it from Barnes & Noble or wherever. There's a link on our show notes. Fred Rosen is here, the author. I've got about another 4 or 5 minutes with you, and I would be remiss, because the last 2 or 3 shows that I've done here, Fred, we've been covering Michael Jackson as much as we can.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm glad you bring that up.
Now, did Michael Jackson ever play Wasilla? I don't think so.
You're funny. I don't think that. I don't know. He might have played Anchorage, which still is a suburb.
Yeah, you know. I guess my point is that Michael Jackson, whether you love him, you hate him, he sold 100 billion records, whatever that is, you know. But
sure.
But there's a dark side. I guess everyone has a skeleton in the closet, but when you open up his, good grief, it's like Fibber McGee, you better run, because there's going to be a lot of things that are falling out on you.
Well, you better explain Fibber McGee.
Yeah, maybe, am I too old? I don't know, an old-time radio show.
An old radio show where a guy would open up a closet and everything would fall out.
Yep,
right?
And there you go.
Actually, this is before my time, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, well, me too, of course, Fred.
That's what I thought, yeah.
You know,
but let me say something about Jackson.
Sure.
I was originally, the thing about Michael Jackson's case that's really interesting, and I think people should look out for this, is that the police in Los Angeles, the police department is headed by Bill Bratton, who I also write about in Deadly Angel by coincidence.
Yes.
And Bill Bratton is really an innovator as far as I'm concerned when it comes to police procedures and policing in general. He's the guy who came to New York City and cut the crime to nothing, mm-hmm. basically. And there he is in Los Angeles now doing the same thing, and I am very surprised that Bratton has already announced, don't be surprised if we pursue manslaughter charges against one of the doctors who treated Mr. Jackson. This is unusual because very rarely, and I wrote a book years ago called Doctors from Hell, which is all about doctors who abuse patients, it's very, very, very rare that a doctor gets criminally charged in any sort of case, let alone Los Angeles.
Right.
And so now I'm looking at this thing and I'm going, whoa, I mean, this is going to really be something if they charge Dr. Murray, who was the physician by Mr. Jackson's side when he died, with manslaughter, as People magazine has been reporting it.
You know,
very surprised, but yeah. But not well. I'll be surprised, but at the same time, it's sure going to be interesting because we're going to find out exactly what happened.
Well, you look at go back to Elvis and the doctor there, Nicopolis, and the tens of thousands of pills, and I think his license was suspended for 3 weeks or something, and he goes
right. That's what usually happens.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get charged.
Yeah.
You don't get charged, let alone with manslaughter.
But,
now again, it hasn't happened. We'll see if it does. But it sure as heck is interesting.
Well, yeah, and I got in trouble with from Howard K. Stern's lawyer when I had Rita Cosby on the show, and we were mm-hmm. talking about Anna Nicole Smith.
Yes.
And I got a kind of a cease and desist letter saying, you better be quiet and don't touch my client. Now Howard K. Stern is in trouble as far as picking up prescriptions. We've got the crying Judge Seidlin, who is making the rounds on Geraldo and all the shows now, and he was the one to talk about enabling. We use that term, and I guess when you see that, you see these celebrities that die too young, I'll agree, but
right.
You look at the culture of prescription medication, I think that in itself is a big story besides how the entertainer died. The prescription medication problem is huge in this country and yours.
Not only do I agree with that, I would say that it's an historic problem in show business. You can go back, and I'm sure you could probably go back even into the 20s, but certainly into the 1930s when Judy Garland was given medication in order to, as a 16-year-old, to complete help me out here, Over the Rainbow, The Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a regular. See, the thing is, there's a culture of this, as you point out, of enablers. I mean, that's a current term. Especially in Los Angeles, which is the cornerstone of show business, and these individuals latch on to people who are entertainers, and sometimes they're employed by the entertainer, sometimes they're employed by their manager, sometimes they're employed by the studio. You don't see the studio thing as much anymore, but they're certainly employed. Otherwise, we're not sitting here having this discussion about Mr. Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself is not unusual. What is unusual is the fact that they're going after this dude.
Yep.
And my feeling is everybody's obviously entitled to the presumption of innocence, but I think you have to pursue this as far as you can go, because I certainly wondered about it. I mean, I don't think a 50-year-old man dies from natural causes.
No.
I just don't think that happens. I'm sorry. There's always a reason.
No, it's good, and I hope they investigate it right to the final T. And
I think they will. Yeah. I think they will, Dana. Bill Bratton is a tough cop. He's not going to cover anything up. It's not his style. And this could be quite interesting. I mean, it could be interesting insofar as you might actually have a trial. And if it does happen, if they actually charge the dude, and there is a trial, oh my God!
Wow.
I mean, you know, talk about a media circus.
Yeah, look out for sure. Fred's website, fredrosen.com. The new book is called Deadly Angel. Thank you, sir.
Hey, Dana, it's always a pleasure. Please stay safe, sir.
We will talk soon.
Okay.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That's Fred Rosen, and it's always good to have him. And check out the book, again, Deadly Angel. I love these cold case stories. They're fascinating. We're going to, actually, what we're doing with Robin Sachs, what Robin Sachs and I did, oh, I better be careful, I'm getting myself into trouble here. We sat down and recorded her Nothing But the Sachs segment a little early. She's in New York City, and here's Robin. All right, we're back. At the time that we record this, Dr. Conrad Murray's lawyer, Ed Chernoff, has released a statement regarding a raid on Dr. Murray's office. And one of the sources say that the warrant is seeking evidence of the offense of manslaughter. Of course, this has to do with Michael Jackson, and Dr. Conrad Murray is one of the doctors under the microscope, excuse the pun, of where Jackson was getting all of his medication. I thought we would do our just the Sachs. Why I always want to say that. Our Nothing But the Sachs segment with former prosecutor Robin Sachs. She's an author. She's a television commentator and a very busy lady. And she's in New York City. Hi, Robin.
Hi, from the Big Apple. I love the city.
Yeah, you bet. What's going on with Dr. Conrad Murray and, of course, the media? As soon as they see the grounds, so to speak, or one of the grounds to search for the evidence of manslaughter all over this like a bird on a bug, what's that about?
Well, it's so interesting because everyone, the news reports that are going all over the place on this case, it's really been fascinating. Now, being able to speak freely as a former prosecutor, I hear, I get tips, I get information, I hear contradicting things, and I know a lot of the people that are involved. And the word out from the Los Angeles Times over the weekend was, and that came from a law enforcement official who wanted to be anonymous, however, said that he was involved in the investigation, said, no, there's not going to be any manslaughter. It's not a manslaughter or a homicide investigation. Pretty much that's put to rest. And I was telling folks back a couple days ago that, you know, don't be so sure on that, because I think that if I were to look into my glass ball, and this be my opinion, that I do see homicide charges, particularly involuntary manslaughter, being filed on Dr. Murray. And what happened today was that the officials of DEA went in and did execute a search warrant in order to look for records, look for information. And I think it's very telling that you obviously were seeing from the lawyer's release and from the lawyer's at least statements that have been made previously that Dr. Conrad Murray has been more than cooperative and more than willing to turn everything over. Well, if he's been so cooperative, why is it that the DEA and LAPD and every other alphabet group involved wanted to go in and conduct and do a search pursuant to a search warrant? And that tells me that they really are trying to catch him off guard. They're using, they're not treating him like a non-suspect. They are very much treating him in the ways of a suspect. And as you know, Dana, from your law enforcement experience, the best way to get information is to get it on the fly and to get it by surprise.
Yep.
You don't want to have Dr. Murray have a chance to redact anything, change anything, destroy anything. There's already been evidence in this case that there has been potential destruction of evidence. And in order to have a basis for that search warrant, they had a list of crimes. And someone signed under penalty of perjury, and that being the officers involved, that this is a crime that they're looking at. So that's a pretty darn reliable source of saying, hey, this is very much an open homicide investigation in a long, very long-winded, fact way.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here. And TMZ.com, who have been doing a great job covering this story, are also reporting.
Really, they've been amazing, actually. Isn't it funny how the tabs have been better than the official news, as we call them?
Well, you know, there's a tabloid aspect to this, and they're saying that two robbery homicide detectives from LAPD, Houston PD officers, DEA, you name it, are working on this. And it goes back right to the start, Robin, where there's criticism in the media about why wasn't the house that he allegedly was given this medication in sealed off right from the get-go, and like you say, potential evidence being destroyed. How important will that be in this case?
Well, destruction of evidence, if you can prove destruction of evidence, is actually a helpful factor in terms of proving what we call consciousness of guilt in the legal world. There's actually a jury instruction that says that if you willfully destroy information or evidence, and that you can look at that as a factor to tend to show that you are guilty, it's an inference of guilt. And so far, from what I understand, we know that there's been reports of a security camera surveillance tape, that has already been is missing the surveillance of what would have been inside the Jackson home video. And we also know that there was found in the, it was reported on Geraldo last week, I was actually on the air with the investigators who had reported this, that there had been bottles of different medications that were found in the trash. Now, who knows if those were actually used or there was a destruction of evidence at that point, but certainly there's a spilled bottle. And I think that and perhaps even the most telltale consciousness of guilt and what I would kind of refer to as a sort of destruction of evidence was the flight of Dr. Murray. I mean, hello, where was he when Michael Jackson was pronounced dead? Where was he when the ambulance pulled up? Where was he when the police were there? And why did his car have to be impounded? in order to figure out who that car belonged to and find out where the doctor was. Those types of factors are certainly going to be relevant. They're certainly going to be information that are going to be looked at in terms of the provability of this case.
There's certain what they call elements that have to be proven in order to bring a charge of manslaughter, and there are certain elements that maybe people don't understand in a case like this. Let's talk about that. What do you need as a DA to go into court with a charge of manslaughter and be able to prove it?
Well, what you need to, in an involuntary manslaughter type of case, this is not a case like a first-degree murder where you have a specific intent or a deliberate intention to kill. That's first-degree murder. That's the murder we all know about. I want to kill you. I'm going to make this plan. I'm going to do it. That's not what Conrad Murray would be facing. And that's the kind of murder that's, you know, what facing, you can be facing many, 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 many years to life, and even death penalty. The Conrad Murray in an and basically just kind of go through it a little bit, is anything that's not first-degree murder can be a presumption that there could be a second-degree theory unless you then find a voluntary or involuntary manslaughter theory. Voluntary manslaughter is a heat of passion type of a killing. It is a, and I think we talked about a lot last week a little bit, where we talked about, you know, you walk in on your wife having an affair and you decide to blow the brains out of the person that, either her or the person she's having the affair with, and after some sort of thing caused you to not necessarily deliberately and plan, but you actually did it within the heat of passion. And the next kind is the involuntary manslaughter, which is, you know, you owed a duty to this person. This is the theory that they would use. Dr. Murray owed a duty as a doctor, as a caretaker, and he should have known, or the fact that element C, the person, would have known or should have known or had the knowledge, experience, skill, or what have you, to preserve or prevent death or to make sure that there's, you know, life. Right. And you did not, and you failed to act within that duty. It's more of a failure to act with a reckless disregard for human life combination. And that's what Conrad Murray is looking at here.
Now, you and I have covered many cases over the time that we've known each other, and this is probably about as high profile as you can get. Now, even you got involved in the headlines somewhat, and now as a former prosecutor, Robin Sachs, you're able to go on, and you've been very busy doing these types of media programs to discuss this and other cases. And I want to get into that a little bit. What's it like traveling around, going on the shows, and being able to, and this is my term, not yours, speak freely, so to speak?
Well, it's interesting. There's certainly a censoring that happens, an internal censoring, an internal barometer of making sure that, A, that you not only represent yourself completely accurately, but you don't represent your office or look like a fool when you're on the radio or TV. And besides the, you know, the wanting to make sure that you're correct and that you don't misstate the law and look like an idiot, that pressure, although it's always still there because I still never want to look like an idiot and not want to look like that I don't know the law. However, the one part is I can actually be able to insert my personal opinion,
right,
which is so liberating, because a lot of people think that just because you're a prosecutor, you automatically think everybody's guilty, everyone should fry, everyone should, you know, hang, you know, get the death penalty or what have you. And I'm not Nancy Grace. I have tremendous respect for her. I think she does an amazing job, and she has her style and her platform. And that my style and my platform has always been a balanced platform and a justice platform. I've always really believed that you know, people who commit crimes, you have the evidence to prove them. We should talk it to them. People who should be held accountable for the crimes that they did. But there's so many people out there. We have enough work to keep us busy with the guilty people. I don't need to fry innocent people. I don't have time for that. And I think it's a travesty and an atrocious miscarriage of justice when we spend energy and time convicting people that shouldn't be convicted, convicting people on crimes that frankly aren't worth our time, like marijuana cases. I talked about that before. So this is really an opportunity for me not to have to, you know, say, you know, and keep with the company line and be able to have, you know, my own personal opinion and be able to start expressing those. And even touch to the point that I'm now re-looking through all the documents that I can get my hands on the Michael Jackson case, to make sure that I wasn't so jaded and so prosecutor mindset in terms of the child molestation charges, and really try to look at them with a fresh set of eyes. So not to say that I've changed my opinion in any way, because so far I have not. I still think that he was horribly inappropriate. I still think that he may have done, you know, obviously he was acquitted, and so, you know, he will, you know, these are all allegations, but the way the evidence were, I still have problems with Michael Jackson as a potential sex offender. Right. So, but I want to make sure that I'm correct on that, and I have now the luxury and ability to be able to do it most of the time.
Robin Sachs is here with our weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. Your state, you're from California, the legislator assembly there, the Governor Schwarzenegger, whatever you want to call them, decided today is a budget cutback, and I've seen two media stories. One says 47,000 prisoners. The other one says 74,000 prisoners, regardless, have been given...
Have been given
early release as a tax saving, as a way to save money because California is broke. Your thoughts as a, first of all, as a person who lives in California, as a former prosecutor, and as someone who covers these sorts of stories, should we be letting people out of jail just to try and save money?
You know, one of the biggest complaints I have and bones to pick that I have with the criminal justice system is, A, the release of prisoners from jail, early release as a good time, work time, even, and budget reasons in particular. But more importantly, when I was a misdemeanor trial lawyer a long time ago, and I used to do these low-level crimes, as they would call them, DUI, small, minor batteries, assault, small, you know, very, you know, the misdemeanors, the things that don't have a lot of time attached to them, don't have a lot of penalty attached to them, and usually aren't given a lot of care by the judges, juries, and frankly, they're actually the hardest cases to prove. And I always thought, and I still think, and I stand by this, that if we, instead of giving people a million chances, if we were to treat misdemeanors, crime seriously, where there was actually some sort of real punishment, we could probably save money and save space by not having people have to spend these long-term sentences in prison later on, and thus have room to roll through the misdemeanor people, because there's so many of those. But instead, what we do is we give misdemeanor people no punishment whatsoever. They get convicted of, you know, one, two, three, four different misdemeanor crimes. They get into felony land. Then all of a sudden, they don't do their time there. And then then they go kill someone, or they go do something really violent, and all of a sudden they're spending massive amounts of time in prison, and the defendant is like, wait, this never happened to me before, and you know, B, they're expecting to get out and can't, you know, really stomach the idea of actually doing some real hard time. So I'm totally opposed to releasing people early. There's got to be, and there is other ways to save money. You know, I could... How about not giving any county cars to people who already have cars anyway? How about, you know, that's, yeah, you know, $25,000 to $30,000 a year car, not to mention the gas. How much money could we save if we cut that and make them take public transit or drive their own darn cars, or if we commute at work or do more working from home and home offices? I mean, there's got to be a gazillion other ways to do it, in my mind, that is not about putting people on the street and not giving people the deterrent effect of time that we deserve.
Yeah, exactly. The deterrent factor of it is so huge, and I think the government's making a huge mistake there. Let's talk about Justice Interrupted, your radio show. I went to tune in last night, and instead I got a rerun of John and Kate plus 8 on that channel. No, I didn't. You guys...
We knew you wanted to watch it. Come on now.
You guys have decided to take a little hiatus. Tell us what's going on.
We have. You know what? Now that I've been spending so much time in the East Coast, I found out what people back here do. And you know, they do it in Washington, D.C. for the month of August. People go to the Hamptons during the summer here. And Justice Interrupted has been running every week faithfully. We've never taken a break. And unlike you being able to tape here in advance, we're not able to do it. We're very much glued to our time. And we feel that given how much travel and inability for all three of us to be there and for the project we've gone on, that we were going to take some time during this summer to regroup, reconnect, and also really come out with a bang in fall. We have some new things that were planned in store, some announcements that we're hoping to make, and if nothing else, we'll definitely be well rested for fall. We're not going anywhere. We're just taking a break, and we will be back just after Labor Day.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs, the segment is called Nothing But the Sachs. She's an author, former prosecutor, you name it, a victims advocate. She blogs. She comes on this radio show, and she's always welcome here. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Dana. Have a good week. I'll see you next week.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs with our weekly Nothing But the Sack segment, taped a couple of days in advance, but I think still very relevant. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. And we are back here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and yeah, it was nice of Robin to call in from the city so nice. I named it twice, New York, New York. She's out there promoting her most recent book and making the circuit and talking about Michael Jackson. It's going to be interesting to see now that the doctors are being scrutinized. Fred Rosen and I have talked about it, and we've all talked about it, many different guests, many different venues here on this program, to find out and see what's actually going to happen with this case. The other case that has fallen off the media trend a little bit is the Anna Nicole case, Howard K. Stern, and the other two doctors that are not in front of the courts on manslaughter charges, but they are nevertheless in front of the courts on prescription drug type charges, where they prescribed, or they didn't prescribe, but drugs were prescribed to Anna Nicole Smith and they were supplied, and it's a huge case. The prescription drug issue across the United States is a huge one, for lack of a better term. It's a huge problem, not only the celebrity aspect, all the way going back to Elvis, and like Fred Rosen said so aptly, even before that with actors and actresses going back to the 30s, 40s, 50s. It's a huge issue. You know, we do have a war on terror, a war on crime, a war on drugs. What about the prescription drugs and the abuse and the doctors that double doctor and overprescribe and all that sort of stuff? So good on the attorney generals out there like Jerry Brown, states like California, states like New York, other states that are trying to crack down on it. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And just before the end of the show, Red from ScaredMonkeys.com, the chief cook and bottle washer over there, has checked in. We haven't had Red on the show for a while. Hey, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fine, Dana. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. You know, I told a story earlier to Clint Van Zandt about me saying to the guy in the back of the patrol car, there's only one idiot in here. And, you know, feel free to go to court and tell the judge I told you that, and he did. And I can remember another story here where a guy said, classic thing to a police officer, I pay your salary and my taxes. And I said to him, okay, I tell you what, I bet you I pay more taxes than you do. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, why did I say that? So the guy shows up at the office with his tax notice, and thank God I had brought mine down, and I did pay like $300 or $400 more a year than he did. So that shut him up for a little while. But, you know, police are human, too, but this whole thing, and I cannot believe Barack Obama. First of all, he starts talking about a health care that he hasn't even read the bill, and now he's commenting on a local case and polarizing racial divide all over the country. And will the guy ever learn to shut up?
Well, I mean, Dana, I mean, Barack Obama, our training wheel president in chief here. I mean, it's getting to be, you know, it gets a little old after a while. I mean, everything that many of us talked about before this man ever became president is coming home to haunt us in tenfold. We knew he was a rank amateur, and he's certainly showing it. We knew, you know, he had said to us while sitting in the pews for 20 years, listening to a racist Reverend Wright, mm-hmm. that he had never been in any of those sermons.
Right.
Now, the problem, the whole arrest police thing aside,
yep.
there's a fundamental problem where a president of the United States automatically assumes that the police were wrong and there was racism involved.
Yep.
All because this man happens to be black, the cop was white, and this is a buddy of the president's.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Clint had said it as well when he was on the show. Barack Obama represents 310 million people. He does not represent himself. He does not represent a certain segment of the population. He doesn't even represent what was once his constituents in Illinois. And he has yet to understand the enormity of this office. What he says matters, which is kind of amazing that we have to apologize for his words,
mm-hmm.
because isn't that what all this man is?
Yeah.
He's the teleprompter-in-chief. He has these things set out. And which the only thing I will disagree with Clint Van Zandt is, I don't think that this was a complete rookie mistake. I think that this thing was completely contrived,
yeah.
and it got out of hand like a wildfire.
Yeah. Well, it's ingrained in Obama's mind for sure. He's proven it time after time after time. And kudos go out to the Cambridge police sergeant for having the cojones to sit back and say, I didn't do anything wrong. Now Obama's in the media tonight actually saying that he's invited Gates and Crowley to the White House for a beer to hold hands and make up. But it's a lot bigger than that. And I hope the sergeant turns him down. Or if he does go, you know, take his family with him, make a vacation out of it. But still say, I'm not apologizing for anything because I didn't do anything wrong.
I mean, the amazing part about this, Dana, is that a president of the United States jumped to a conclusion, he wants to say that he didn't impugn the character of these people. Of course that's what he did.
Sure he did, yeah.
I mean, he called them racist. When the fact of the matter is, the professor, the good professor at Harvard, who, what we're not bringing into a lot of this is, a Harvard professor is an elitist
mm-hmm.
by nature. This man, from the comments that you heard, was not only race baiting this officer, he was acting like John Kerry, saying, don't you know who I am?
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff goes on in that section in Boston all the time. And what's amazing about this is, just like how me, not a black man, wouldn't be mouthing off to some Alabama state trooper, I don't think I'd be mouthing off to Boston police people either.
No.
I mean, there comes a what good can come of mouthing off to a cop except for spending a night in the hooscow?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, seriously.
And it's quick to, or they're quick, the governor, the mayor, even the police chief, who is somewhat backtracked down as supporting the sergeant, are quick again without knowing the facts to kowtow and say, we're sorry, this should never happen. I think the charges should have proceeded with.
I mean, you know what the problem, you know what the, once again, I mean, and it's like a broken record with Barack Obama in these situations, because a while back, if you remember, and I wrote about it this evening,
yep.
On Scared Monkeys, was Barack Obama went on one of the late night talk shows and made an ignorant comment about Special Olympics.
Right.
And completely just made fun of people with special needs.
Yep.
It was as insensitive a comment and as stupid a comment that has ever been made by a sitting president. But now, what was our takeaway from that? He said it was a learning experience, it was a teaching experience, and that we could have a dialogue about it.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that exactly what he said about this issue, where he's not sorry he really made the comments, he's sorry that they've got blown out of proportion and that the media actually covered them. That's what he's sorry about. He's not sorry about making the comment, because he hasn't yet apologized for that. But what did he say? This is a teaching, it's a learning experience. For who?
Mm-hmm.
Him? What is the learning experience that we need to learn? That people need to stop crying racism when there is none? Now, granted, I'd be the first to admit, does racism still exist in the United States of America? Of
yes.
course it does.
Yeah.
But stop crying rape, stop crying racism when it doesn't exist, because it basically takes away from the times that it does. And there's no, I mean, there's nothing worse than a racist. There's nothing worse than a rapist. There's nothing worse than a pedophile. But the only thing worse than all three is accusing someone of that when you know that they're not.
Absolutely. And Red is here from Scared Monkeys. When I heard the president's response in the press scrum, and he said the Cambridge police acted stupidly, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, how many times does this guy have to put his foot in his mouth before someone takes it out and puts it up his rear end? Because this is it's enough is enough. Criticize George Bush as much as you like. That's part of taking the job. But this guy is just, I think he made the term training wheels, and he's fallen off them several times.
And George W. Bush was supposed to be the misinformed president, right?
Right.
He was supposed to be the stupid one.
Yeah.
Barack Obama was supposed to be the intellectual, smart, wordsmith, orator, all of this stuff. And every single time this happens, And what we learn is that he's a completely contrived candidate.
Yep.
If it were not for the media, if it were not for liberal guilt, this man never would have been put in office. And to be and what makes matters worse is that, in a roundabout way, do I think that this thing was planned? I do. I don't think that this just happened. No one can tell me, because we all know that the Obama press conferences are completely contrived.
Yep.
Everybody knows who's going to be called on ahead of time. Everybody knows what the question is that he's going to have to answer. So when this question, when he couldn't answer the first 11 questions that were asked regarding the disastrous healthcare press conference, which was a bunch of crock in its own right, the last question of the evening was this question about race, about the arrest, and about this Harvard professor, and that was known ahead of time.
Yep.
So what that would have meant was Obama would have been prepared for this question. So this wasn't like he was walking the line somewhere and some reporter out of nowhere stuck a microphone in his face and said, what about this?
Yep.
And he said something off the cuff.
Yep.
This, as much as it could be, was a prepared answer. I don't think Obama figured he would get the response that he got, because he lives in this world of denial that thinks he's a perfect candidate, even though his approval ratings are going down like the SS Titanic these days. But when this man made that comment, I kind of have to believe it was a diversion to make the media cover a story other than healthcare. Because that's been nothing but an absolute disaster for this man. And as one of the politicians said, might be his Waterloo.
Yeah, for sure. I'll end it like this, Red. You said the SS Titanic. Well, they hit an iceberg. I would consider his presidency more like the SS Minnow that landed on Gilligan's Island. Thank you, sir.
You take it easy.
Okay, buddy.
Good night,
Dana. Bye-bye. That's Red from ScaredMonkeys.com. It's always nice to have him check in. That's it. That's tonight's show. We'll see you again next week here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.